VentureCast.
That's one of the great. That's one of the greatest. Woo!
And oh man,
that one's so good.
What a fun bass line. Just hanging out, chilling.
And then the next verse is, "I wish I were a brakeman,
yeah,
a hurtling evening train."
Yeah.
Oh, right. Me too, my brother. If there's anything I would like better than being a fisherman, it's being a brakeman.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Martin in Knoxville, how's it going?
Things are just bumping along nicely here in Knoxville, Tennessee. I've got two different pieces of good news.
Oh, all right.
Hit it.
First, you find me in fine fettle. I had the first wine and cheese party for a law school class since fall 2019. We had to do it outside on the front porch in 50-degree weather.
Sure.
But we were unmasked and just had a fine time. So I'm a little looser than normal. Blame it on the cheese, not the blame it on the cheese.
Are you loose? I love it.
And then the second thing is we had a local election here in your Knoxville.
Uh-huh.
And not one, not two, not three, not four, but five incumbents on the city council all won re-election.
Wow.
Going away. And these were people that IndyKing Canada endorsed. So it's just winning really pretty here.
Unbelievable. Wow.
Terrific.
Yeah, no, for sure. She's doing a bang-up job, and the people recognized it.
Oh, it really sounds like she should run some national governor campaigns.
Because, yeah, man, that would be a tough guess. A
couple of races, we had some unforeseen face planting by folks. Wow.
A little bit. Speaking of race and Virginia, guess which novel won the Pulitzer Prize in 1988?
Beloved.
Beloved by Toni Morrison. I mean, who could argue with the greatness of that novel?
We had an argument about that at book club, and a buddy of mine was arguing he didn't care for it. And I was like, wow, it's a terrible take. I love that book.
Oh, me too. That book. It's not my favorite Morrison, which is saying something, because Beloved is an all-timer.
What's your favorite?
Song of Solomon.
Wow.
Woo!
Okay. I really love Song of Solomon.
But to think this Virginia governor's race was affected by Beloved being taught in an AP English class.
Yeah, I know. How about that?
Unbelievable. And by the way, not everybody takes AP English. Did you take AP English in high school, Jeff?
We did not have AP courses at my crazy little crunchy granola school. But
We may have. I never went near that hallway, so I'm not sure exactly what was happening.
I love that it was a hallway. It was like the nerd smart kid hallway at Scituate High.
That's right.
First of all, Timmy, you were writing op-eds for the Scituate situation. I don't think you can brag on being a regular person.
I was a man of the people with my column.
My column came from my man of the people status. No luck to me.
Mike Barnicle.
Situation. Did it have both words, or was it just the situation?
No, just the situation. That was the name of the paper.
Misspelled with S-E-I-T?
Yeah, it was spelled like the town.
That dumbass from Jersey Shore, when he had his 15 minutes, were you just dying when that situation guy was famous for
it? I didn't spell it right. It wasn't named after Scituate, so it was no use to Timmy at all.
That's not a bad name for him to give himself, though. The Scituate. What was the name of your backing band with Rich Price?
Rich Price.
The Foundation, just straight Foundation.
Rich Price and the Foundation. I like that name.
That's a good name. I like that name too. All right. Well, welcome to 1988. Lots to cover. You all are headed off to college. I am finishing up high school. And we are all listening to the Grammy-winning album of 1988, George Michael's Faith.
No way. That won the Grammy, huh? It's a
freaking great record. That is a great record. I love it at the time. I still love it.
Which song should I play, Benny B?
Oh, just go with Faith. But you have to skip ahead like, I don't know, a minute to get to the part.
Okay,
a lot of strumming.
And also, isn't Father Figures on that one? And then what's the sad one? That like the 6 minute ballad where he's like,
turn a corner. No, Monkey? Wham. No, it's not Monkey.
Good guess.
It's One More Try, isn't it?
Yeah. One More Try is beautiful.
Here's Faith a minute in.
It's the Grammy winner. It's the number one album.
Faith by George Michael.
All the games you play, the guys I play them too. Oh, but I need some time off from that emotion. Time to pick my heart up off the floor. Oh, when that love comes down with a devotion. Well, it takes the strong man, baby, but I'm showing you the door. Cause I gotta have faith.
Woo! Good stuff.
Baby.
I know.
So this song is why he won the stupid Grammy. It's classic. It's a throwback 50s beat remixed. And you know, all those old guys were like, hey, now.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Right.
The same way everybody felt it like when Amy Winehouse won the Grammy. There are a bunch of old soul singers that were like, ahem.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
That's my sound.
But it is, I mean, listen, like if you've listened to the Wham records, this is a significant leap forward.
Oh yeah.
Record. Like he really put it all together here.
Imagine Andrew. I hope he gave it to Andrew originally before it came out so he could prepare himself.
I know, like, just emotionally.
You hear that on release day, you're just like, damn.
He also had I Want Your Sex on this album, which is...
Yeah, I assume that scared a young Timothy away.
That was too much.
I like that one also.
I don't really understand the phrasing, actually. So I'm going to call him out on poor grammar.
that was your beef with it, Timmy?
I want to have
You know, one of the problems you were having with having sex in 1988 was your grammar, I think.
my grammar and my nervousness. Anyways, let's go on. In 1988, The Phantom of the Opera debuts. Al-Qaeda is formed.
Also not good. Probably even worse than Phantom of the Opera, and I didn't even think that was possible until you juxtaposed those.
Yeah, put them together. In 1988, CDs outsell records for the first time. Jeff, could you give me 30 seconds on the sound quality difference between a CD and a record? Go.
Ooh, no, it takes about 4 hours. No, when CDs first came out, everybody got excited because they didn't click and pop, and you didn't have to be extra careful, and they wouldn't scratch. And because there was this sense that they were digitally perfect, and that every single one would be a duplicate of the other, and it wouldn't matter where your album was pressed or what the quality of the vinyl was and the run that you had. People were like, this is great. We'll throw all our old vinyl away. And then it turned out that digital music lacks a warmth and sonic palette that great vinyl has. You know, it's just
compressed too.
It's compressed. You get fewer highs and lower lows, and that the quality of the recording moving from all digital, from analog, the technology wasn't quite there. So actually there's a moment from like 87 to 93 when CDs don't sound very good at all.
Okay.
But that's the moment when they were like, bye-bye records. And so what we have now is you have these kind of boutique, small batch, heavy weighted records that get released of this moment of CDs that are selling very well because they are a little warmer and sound a little bit better. Like, I'll bet George Michael's Faith on 180 gram vinyl remastered actually sounds better than it originally did in this moment when it came out on CD.
Huh.
Having said that, my hearing is so beat up from playing that to pretend I can hear a huge difference would be to lie to you. I can hear when something's been mixed better. Like, there have been remasters that have come out in the last 10 years where I'm like, whoa, that sounds so much better than it used to.
Okay.
But it's not vinyl CD. It's just the quality of the mix and mastering.
But it's also like the CD then eventually just killed the audio file.
Yeah.
Like most people listen, like, and Jeff can correct me, but listening to music online through Spotify is even more compressed. And basically, by compressed, we mean sampled. Like, they can't get every single piece of digital information. It's too big. There's this thing called FLAC, a fully lossless audio codec? What's the C?
Coding.
Where they literally have every single thing coded, and it's too big. It takes up like huge chunks of your hard drive if you have it. So they compress it to the CD, and then because now, like, Spotify's sending that over the over the internet, like, they can't be having it as big as a CD, so they're sampling even more.
So what just happened a month ago is Apple Music changed all of its streaming to the lossless.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. So if you've got the internet speed, you can actually now stream, and Spotify is slowly upgrading all of its files to the lossless quality.
Oh, that's interesting.
If you're on the road, if you're in your phone, if you're in your car, you won't hear the difference because of the speakers you have. But if you're at home with a super fast connection and a pair of great speakers, you now, your Apple Music is now studio quality, which is incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And they didn't change the price.
Huh.
So
Jeff will agree with me on this. One of the great joys of life is to talk to insane people, and some insane people are audiophiles.
Yeah.
So, right. I mean, I had an evening in Phoenix, Arizona with a work friend of India's husband, where he was like, "Would you like to come to my garage and see my reel to reel setup?" And I was like, "Would I? Would I?" And we went back in his garage, and he had it set up with surround sound and 85 speakers, and it looked like the old Motown setup. Like, I mean, it was like as if it was a studio. And he was like, "Listen, man, I don't know." He's like, "Do you like CDs or records?" And I was like, "I guess I kind of prefer records, but I mean not." And he was like, interrupted me. He's like, "Wrong answer. Reel to reel. I only listen to reel to reel."
Wow.
He got out like his original reel to reel masters is the Rolling Stones Sticky Finger. He was like, "What band do you like?" I was like, "Stones." Put on Sticky Fingers. And I'll be frank, it was fantastic. Holy crap. I was like, "Does it all sound like that?" He's like, "It all sounds like that." And I was like, "How much did this run to?" He's like, "I don't know, 35, 40 grand. And I was like, "And you're married? how did you stay married?" And the irony is they got divorced like 3 months later. When I came back in, Indy and I left. We had a lovely time with these people. She's like, "Yeah, when I signed with a husband," I was like, "Oh yeah, but they're getting divorced." And she was like, "What do you mean?" I was like, "This dude's like spent 35 grand on a reel to reel setup, and all it does is get high and listen to music. That's not working out for anybody."
That's like the Boston guy. He's like, yeah, I spent the down payment on the house.
Sure. By the way, I admired the guy. I was like, if only I were you, that would be amazing. But no luck.
Wow.
I can't believe you pre-called the divorce. Like,
you guys both must have seen that, though. There are times where you can look at a couple and you're like, "Well, that's not going to work."
Yeah.
You guys could have said something to me when you saw that.
We walked right into that, didn't we, Ben? That's too bad. All right, moving along briskly. Let's go to the we did the Grammy. We're going to do the best-selling album. Well, it's Faith again.
Okay. So
instead of the best-selling album contained within 1988, the best all-time selling album that came out in 1988, and that would be Fast Car by Tracy Chapman.
No. Well, it's just called Tracy Chapman, but are you demanding?
Oh, sorry.
The all-time best-selling record from 1988?
According to my statistics.
Good for Tracy Chapman.
How many records did that sell?
Lots.
All right, I'm looking this up, Timmy.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.
Yeah, 20 million albums.
Hey!
That's a lot of albums.
Give the ball.
Hey, Timmy, do you know who discovered her?
Brian Koppelman. Our friend, he was up at Tufts, and I think he was in Cambridge on a T stop, and she was performing I think at the Harvard Square T stop. And he listened to her and he missed his train. And then he ended up bringing her demo tape to his dad, who worked at a record company. So good stuff.
And then David Kirschenbaum's the producer, right? This is a brilliant example of taking somebody off the street and letting them be themselves and doing just enough in production to sweeten it up, but not
yeah,
so
support
much
them. Yeah.
The reason you signed her in the first place. Like
exactly.
She never makes another great record after this one. There's no question about it. Then the following two records are a huge step down, and it's because they went from a budget of 20 grand to a budget of 5 million, you know, but these almost sound like demos, and that's why they're so appealing. And the songs are like, her later songwriting becomes a parody of the songwriting on this, which is totally fine. Like, I mean, she wrote one amazing record, and most people don't do that at all. But Fast Car's great. Baby Can I Hold You is great from this record.
Oh, love Baby Can I Hold You.
Yeah.
Talk about Revolution.
There's some stuff that's aged really badly though. Like the domestic violence song is not good. And the a cappella song is just really, really hard to listen to.
They could have given her a little more support on that one.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe a drum.
But I have nothing bad to say about this record of Tracy Chapman. Good on her. If there's somebody who's gonna have a random $20 million killer hit,
yeah,
have it be her.
But there's a song that's just, that was everywhere for two albums later. What was the name of that?
One Reason to Stay Here.
Yeah, that song, man. Golly.
Like a golly of yay, I like it, or a golly of 7 minutes.
Golly of I could not escape that song.
Yeah.
No matter how hard
how I felt about it, yeah.
All right, so in 1988, we have finally a ceasefire in the Iran-Iraq war. That was big. Either of you remember who wins the World Series in 1988?
Yeah, I do.
Who?
The Los Angeles Dodgers beat the Oakland A's in 5 games because of Kurt Gibson's home run.
And in the fall, I was in Dayton, Ohio at the University of Dayton, and I was in the off-campus area of student housing known as the ghetto.
Lovely.
In Dayton, Ohio. And I remember having someone singing every single word of It's the End of the World as We Know It, which is really impressive if you've seen someone pouring beer at a keg and singing every single word of that song. Can you guys sing every single word of that song?
I used to be able to. Ben has heard me sing that song.
Go.
No.
What do you mean? What, you don't want to fill up the time on our podcast?
You're like, that's great. It starts. Then you can fade out.
Timmy, you're like, let's move on briskly. Jeff, could you mumble the lyrics to a mediocre song?
Anyways, it was at that same party where Kirk Gibson hits that home run.
Do you remember, Ben, that a young sports editor of the Byco News called the series in September, Dodgers over the A's in 5? And
yeah, it's strange, Jeff. I do not remember the Bi-College News or that editor as crisply as you might.
Here's the thing I love about that is they made me sports editor. I wrote this column in September where it's like Dodgers over the A's in 5. And I was throwing a dart. And then it happened, and like all these guys who I was invisible to were like, how'd you know that? What was your system? Like, how did you like Nate Medoff and McGiffen and like all the
guys
who were huge sports fans? Like I had this like 3-day window where they were interested in my existence. And then it faded because like I obviously didn't know anything. I think I picked 6 out of the Sweet 16 correctly, and they were like, forget that guy.
Yeah, he's done.
I had this brief moment of sports notoriety.
Well, I'll tell you, I often pit the two of you against each other in competition. And I feel bad about that because you are good friends. And what if I brought the two of you together as a team to play Beat the Clock? So I'm going to give you 30 seconds on the clock for the two of you to name the top 4 television shows of 1988. The top 4, 1 through 4. And I'll give you a hint. They were all on NBC. You can have as many wrong answers as you like. You're trying to nail all 4 on your mark, set, go.
Cheers.
Yes, that is one.
LA Law.
No.
Damn it. Staying Elsewhere?
No.
What else was on that Thursday night? That Thursday night was gigantic.
Oh, Night Court was on for a while, but I think
Friends? It's all- Seinfeld?
Nope, nope.
We Got It Made?
Close.
A Different World? Is that still Cosby?
Yes, Show? A Different World.
Oh, The Cosby Show.
The Cosby Show.
We're 3 for 4. It's one of them. Give us a hint. Is it a 30-minute show?
Now it's a drama.
Oh, it's 30. It was a sitcom.
NYPD Blue?
It was a sitcom. There are going to be people listening who are very...
Oh, the one with John Lithgow, where he's Third Rock from the Sun.
Oh, no. It was Golden Girls.
Golden Girls.
That's amazing.
That makes me super happy.
There are definitely people screaming at the podcast.
In yeah.
By the way, we should actually note, Timmy, wrote it down in your notes. When we get to be older than Rue McClanahan was when she started Golden Girls, that's an actual like meme online.
It is.
When you're older than Rue McClanahan, because she was like 46 when they started.
It's like Wilford Brimley in Cocoon. You know, yeah. he was really only 50. It's like, oh man. All right, gentlemen. I think that is it for all the fun facts I have about 1988.
I want to ask Ben if he remembers the first time he was aware of me freshman year. Do you remember meeting me?
Huh.
I'm going to guess not.
I don't think so, no. I mean, I really like you were the by a country mile the best musician at the school. And so I do remember that. Like that was apparent somewhere in freshman year for sure.
And then the sports editor.
Right. And then the sport and your pick in the World Series was amazing to me. But yeah, no, you were the best musician and also just super into music. So we definitely met somewhere in there.
My first memory of you, the first time we actually met was playing Saturday morning intramural basketball against each other.
Oh boy.
In the little gym. Remember when they still
had a
hoop in the little, and you were so just hang dog hungover. Like, you know, in the beginning, we're like warming up. We're all introducing ourselves. I'm like, hey, Jeff is like, I'm Ben. He's like, I apologize in advance. I might throw up on the court. I'm so hungover. And you went 0 for like 70. Like nobody on your team would shoot except you. And you were just like trying. And like after your third shot, you were like, somebody else has to shoot. I'm so hungover. That's my first
way to make a first impression, man.
It was like a Saturday morning, 9 a.m.
First of all, I'm sure there was like a Tuesday morning. I really drank way too much my freshman year.
It was Saturday morning. So. I'm not underselling it. It was a perfectly reasonable morning to be hungover. And it was a totally unreasonable 9 a.m. tip-off for intramural.
Yeah, that's rough for college kids. Whew.
That's a hilarious memory. I don't remember that. That's right.
Of course he doesn't remember. All right, let's get to our three albums.
Our three albums.
Boom. Ben Barton, you get to corner the market. What have you got?
One of the pleasures of doing two seasons is that you can play one season after another. This is the year. This is the year for that. Bring the Noise was my selection for 1988 off of It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And I had an explicit discussion about another rap album that came out that year.
That's explicit.
Rap albums that show diverging paths in, I would say in the wood, but actually in the city, between where we actually went and where we might have gone. I was pretty clear that I actually prefer Public Enemy. I prefer Public Enemy musically. I prefer them rap wise. And I also just much, much prefer that version. Let me just go ahead and be super extra clear on this, though. This is an African-American experience, and those folks can define their experience however they like. Like, I'm not here to explain to NWA about how I would prefer that they express the African-American experience. I'm not going to do that at all. That being said, insofar as white kids from the suburbs drove this, I can have something to say about that experience. I am choosing Straight Outta Compton. That's the album of the year. That's the proto album. This creates, it defines, and guides rap from here into 50 Cent into Club, basically. Like that entire era of hip hop is dominated by NWA. They just lay the wood down right here. It's a super interesting listen. If you haven't listened to the record, I would go back and listen to it again. It's interesting because basically NWA basically has only got one real record, and it's this one. They've got like a couple of weird singles and 12 inches and stuff that they're kind of like cobbling together, Boys in the Hood and stuff that comes out before it. Then they have this massive, gargantuan, chart-topping, genre-creating hit. Ice Cube leaves. They have one final record without Ice Cube. Not as good. And then we're off to the solo races. It's also interesting, listening to it now, how hungry it is. Like, you can really, really, really hear that these guys want to make it in the rap game. And then you're like, well, why would that be the case? I mean, this is like Ice Cube and Dre. Like, these are, and Eazy-E had a significant success as well. You're like, this is among the most successful rappers of all time. You forget that it was 100% New York City, not even an East Coast phenomenon. It was a New York City phenomenon, period. Everybody you've heard of from that time, except with the possible exclusion of Ice-T, are all from the New York metro area. Like, this is before you have any Houston scene, any Atlanta scene, no other scene. Everything's from New York. So that out in LA, in Chicago, anywhere else, they're just scrabbling to get along with it. And you can really feel it in the record. It's a really, really interesting comparison point to, it's a really interesting comparison point to Run DMC and to the Beastie Boys and to Public Enemy. And it's an explicit discussion of that. There's a song, 8-Ball, that samples the Beastie Boys in it. And they're clearly like working off of that. It's also interesting that the West Coast sample style is so different from the East Coast sample style. And it's partially Dre. I mean, what can you say? Dre is just like an absolute master and genius from the first time he cuts a record.
And are you going to explain that difference? Because I'm not even sure. When you talked about Public Enemy, like leaving the concert or the collective, part of the collective left and went back and just started laying down samples. Does that mean they're actually like taking a record, playing a part and taping it?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically it's like, so the very, very first ones would sample an entire bit and then loop over it, right? Okay. So that's Rapper's Delight, where they just take a part of the song and they're going over it. Loop. There's a song that does exactly that on this album. It's Express Yourself, which is just the fantastic soul song, Express Yourself, with Dre rapping over it. And I mean, it's not a shy sample. He just takes that song, cuts out the lyrics, keeps the chorus, Express Yourself, do, and then it's just him rapping over it. Then they've got other ones.
There's a lot of brothers out there.
Then there's other ones that are a little bit more along the lines of what later Run DMC or the Beastie Boys sound like, with like a guitar part coming out, and then a drum beat over it. Then there are parts that are sort of Public Enemy. I mean, Funky Drummer is sampled on this very similarly to how it's sampled on in Public Enemy. But Public Enemy was like gathered it all together and matched it up into this crazy pastiche, and that's not what NWA are doing at all. They're choosing different material and then sampling entire big chunks of the material. And actually, if you're going to blame, I mean, it's tough, but I mean, if you're going to blame somebody for the way it worked out legally, where they were like, you can't sample anything unless you pay them, this record is a better one to point to than NWA, because the NWA one is unrecognizable, except for maybe like there's a couple of Funky Drummer parts, there's a couple of like speeches where you can tell what it is, but musically it's unrecognizable. Whereas in this album, you can call out 10 of the samples just listening to them for sure. You agree with that, Jeff?
Yeah, I do. This feels like, it's less art, like the samples are there to give these guys something to rap over, whereas Public Enemies takes the samples, assembles them into something, and then raps over them. Like, I feel like there's an extra, especially on the next Public Enemy record, like the Fear of a Black Planet is so dense and so thick by comparison to this record, in my opinion. But
yeah so over like the year before this and the year before that, Boogie Down Productions, Eric B. and Rakim, and Ice-T all put out singles. Not, I guess maybe Eric B. and Rakim have an album, but that's sort of proto gangster rap. But I mean, the reviews at the time were really, really clear. They like, there's a review of this record that says it makes Ice-T sound like a Cub Scout, and that's accurate. Like, they just turned it up to 11 on the gangster rap thing, and it's super violent. it's even more upsettingly to me, at least, like as a modern listener, it's like, it's so misogynistic. Like their version of what women are like is just really, really, really hard to wrap your arms around. And again, like that's a thing that lasts for 20 years and maybe still, but I mean, again, it sets the mode for that. I'm going to ask Jeff to play Gangsta Gangsta.
Straight Outta Compton by N.W.A.
Oh shit, man. Them peachy black gangsters are at it again. I wonder who they fucked up today, man.
You motherfucker!
Got him.
Ruthless. Everywhere we go, they say,
damn.
NWA's fucking up the program. And then you realize we don't care. We don't just say no. We're too busy saying yeah. About drinking straight out the eight bottle. Do I look like a motherfucking role model to a kid looking up to me? Life ain't nothing but bitches and money. Cause I'm the type of nigga that's built to last.
Wow. Well.
And one of my really close friends from law school is a guy named Mark Reiner, who's just a super lovely, brilliant lawyer and a Jewish kid from Connecticut. This is his favorite album of all time and his favorite hip hop album. And we had a legitimate argument where I was like, how could you choose this over Public Enemy? Like Public Enemy is so preferable. And he's like, oh no, man. He's like, Straight Outta Compton, that's what it's all about. He's like, life ain't nothing but bitches and money. And I was like, this is later. I was like, dude, you're married with two beautiful daughters and you're an intellectual property lawyer. And he's like, exactly. Bitches and money.
That's perfect. It's rough. I remember my buddy Jay brought this tape up to his room. He's like, listen to this. And we listened to it. And my mouth was on the floor. And I was like, you know, they're talking about killing cops. What's wrong with cops? They protect us. And Jay said, Timmy, we got to find out what's going on out there. We got to find out. We got to go to LA. We got to go to LA and become cops. He's like, you be a teacher, I'll be a cop. Then we're going to change things. And I said, okay. I did not end up going to LA. Jay did go to LA. He's an LA cop working with gangs in South Central. Created a scholarship program like from listening to this album in 1988. He's given his adult life to being a cop in LA and trying to change the dynamic, which is really hard if you know anything about the LAPD.
Yeah, man, that's amazing.
Yeah,
amazing story. The fact that Jay is the book about Jay that Tim needs to write still demands to be written. How that's not one of your screenplays yet, I don't know, but I still find this record really difficult to listen to. I totally get it. I totally appreciate it. It's a piece of art. It opened up a way, not unlike the autobiography of Malcolm X, introduced a new way of talking about race relations in an unapologetic way that was not conciliatory at its center. This record is not conciliatory. This record is a gigantic extended middle finger. And I get all that. And I still find it, I found it difficult to listen to in the moment. I find it difficult to listen to now because it has aged to the point where it does feel a little cartoonish at times. Like I found myself giggling a couple of times in the clip we just played. Like when he says, fuck you at the 35 second mark, it's such a big, loud, hilarious, empty fuck you that actually makes me laugh. I love this record more now thinking of the 18-year-old kids making it, like maybe this will change our lives. Like, and I was skeptical enough in the moment of the narrative that these were dangerous people who needed FBI files. Like that felt like total bullshit to me at the moment, in the moment. But I never connected with it the way Ben did. Like I never, it opened, I mean, it opened my eyes. It opened up a sonic palette, but not one that I was like, oh, I need to hear this again and again and again. And there were guys on my hall who loved it. Jay Fedoroff loved this record. And so I heard it a lot, but yeah, I don't know. It wasn't its politics and it wasn't its confrontational nature. And it wasn't the shocking quality of it that turned me off. But I never clicked with it. Still don't.
Did you say Ice Cube wrote most of the lyrics?
Yeah, totally.
I didn't know. Eazy-E wasn't one of the writers?
No, if you go back and look at it, I mean, Ice Cube gets the credit for almost all of that stuff. And it's actually super fun. Not fun, but the record's got several, like each one gets their own like little solo thing. And the Eazy-E one is 8-Ball. And it's amazing that he was the breakout star off of this record. And
yeah,
actually,
right?
This is one of the things that's really bad about, or not bad, but like this is another reason how it set the tone. The reason Eazy-E was the breakout star is because he really lived the life. He was an actual legitimate murderer and drug dealer. And that's he's not bragging. Like that's an actual thing that he did to make money before that album. And I believe that to be true. He's the worst rapper, like by a mile. The song 8-Ball is, I was like, I listened to it again today. I was like, oh boy, this is bad. Like he's just bad at it.
Yeah.
And so to have him be the breakout, and then the controversy drove the sales. Like they got banned off of MTV, and the FBI wrote them a letter, and they were like, thank you for that. That's amazing news for us, because that just moved units big time. Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's easier for me. First, I admire Dre so much. I just love Dre's entire career. And the production sounds so great. So that makes it easier for me to like. And then also Cube. I've always been a Cube guy. Maybe not some of his later movies. pretty much all of the rap stuff I love. And so the combination of those two guys.
Don't you feel like Cuba Gooding Jr. is at home every night? Like, Cube, you couldn't let me have that lane. You had to swerve in and take
seriously,
dogs four away from me.
good stuff. All right. Jeffrey, you're in the dark.
I know. Sorry. I rushed in to start the podcast without turning in a light in this garage. It's getting dark, but
is it far away?
Yeah, it's pretty far away.
Okay. Go on.
Kind of bicycle. Like, I almost,
Jim, it's an audio medium, man. Let our boy
That's
go.
That's right. He doesn't need.
1988 is an interesting year for rock music. We talked about how hair metal is taking over and those guitar sounds change and Bon Jovi. And for a guy like me who likes rock music and likes it loud and fast, Husker Du breaks up, the hardcore movement is stagnant, and it's hard for me to find heroes. Luckily, the debut record of a pretty interesting band comes out in 1988, and it's my pick of the year.
Ooh.
So one of the things, you know, one of the things that Ben's choice reveals is this, as these guys working alone and creating something totally new. My band is working off of a tradition that's long established and mostly exclusionary for African Americans. And they figure out a way to take rock music and put it through their own filter.
Let's go.
Their own. This is Living Colors year.
Yeah.
The year of Vivid, their first record. There were some huge hits off this record. Cult of Personality is the big one that everybody knows. They also had a big hit with a song called Open Letter to a Landlord. Interestingly, a lot of records that try to be topical don't age well, but Living Color, the first two records, are aging pretty well. Like the things that they're complaining about are still with us.
Yeah.
It's like the song Funny Vibe that talks about fear of African Americans walking down the street. There are songs here worried about the climate and the environment, right? Like these guys are ahead of their times in terms of like putting their finger on social problems that will continue to exist. And so like, you don't get, like you listen to 1960s protest songs and there's always at least a verse where you're like, ooh, you know, where they're like worried about Khrushchev or something like that. Like this record doesn't have that. Production wise, The drum sounds are a little ridiculous. They're enormous. Like the bass and snare, kick drum and snare on this record are still reverberating in whatever studio they were recorded in. And on the ballads, they don't pull it back at all. Like, there's a couple of slow songs in this record, and the drums are like, boom, crack. I mean, they're enormous. And the guitar playing, Vernon Reid is the guitar player, and he comes to this band from underground music. He's a weird metal jazz prog guy. And so you don't get the Eddie Van Halen, like, cool solos here. You get very weird, squawky, squeaky, dissonant stuff. I super dig it. I think it's why the second record stiffs and why Living Color is done after its third record. Like, Vernon Reid's a little too weird to build a career around just a classic straight ahead rock band, but he's a really inventive, very good guitar player. That said, he skews a little metal for me. Like, I wouldn't mind a warmer sound from some of these songs, right? But these guys did what they did, and they did it on all 11 songs. And so, like, uncharacteristically, I actually listened to Vivid this morning. I listened to the whole record on my way to work, and I appreciated that it sounded like a band that set up and played through its live set and put the record out. Like, it's weird. Big drums, slappy bass, crazy weird metal jazz guitar, and, like, really kind of funny soul shouting. Like, it's like Terrence Trent D'Arby Jr. on this record. Like, he's like, I mean, the Glover's a good, he's a good singer. And I think so, he sings some songs particularly well. And then there are moments when he sounds very silly. Like, you know, he's like, his yes or his like really sounds like if James Hetfield, like, somehow ended up in a soul band, you know. That said, I was really struck by how much I liked the songs one after another. The songs are really well written. They have verses and choruses and bridges. Like, there's an attention to detail in the construction of songs. Like, third verses have little awesome extra touches. Like, choruses come back at half speed and then double time. Like, this is a crafted record. It sounds like a band that's written about 15 songs and played them live 50 or 60 times and has gotten inside them and, like, figured out exactly what they want to do and went into the studio and just killed it. And I also appreciate that they position themselves as an African-American band playing rock music, and the places where they throw out love to previous bands are interesting. They cover a Talking Heads song on this record, which is a really interesting place for them to, like, Talking Heads, who started as a little white art rock quartet and grew into a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-gendered 12-piece ensemble, is an interesting place for Living Color to position themselves, right? Like, we are a hybrid of a bunch of different things, and that's deliberate. Like, we're not trying to be anything other than hybridic musicians finding a middle ground between these musical traditions. And when it works, I think it works great. I'm going to play you my favorite number, which is not one of the hits. It's a song called Desperate People, which is track 4. And it's everything I love about this band. It starts with this crazy rave up double time solo, and then it breaks down into this killer funky guitar and bass groove. I can't play the whole thing, but, like, those two themes come back 3 or 4 times, like, reinvented, reinverted. This record's really good. It's aged really well. I loved it then. I saw them at the Tower Theater. We go together to Living Color, Ben? Did we see that show together?
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved it live. They brought it hard. So this is Desperate People from Living Color's Vivid.
Vivid by Living Color.
We'll be right back.
I'm picturing you in the car this morning listening to this. What did your little Michael Jackson kid think as he drove along?
Completely ignored it. It was so funny. Like, I kept hoping they would be like, who is this? And what are you listening to? And it was nothing. Just dead silent in the van. I had it pretty loud, dude. When we were stuck in traffic for like 30 minutes and I didn't like adjust the volume to account for road noise. So there was like a good 30 minutes when I was blowing them out. But I
was texting his mother, terrified.
Yeah, like, help.
Yeah. All right. So you guys went to a In Living Color show together.
I'm pretty sure that's right. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Some of the Tower Theater, not In Living Color. Like, that's
sorry. You're absolutely right. Living Color. Tell me.
The other thing I loved about Living Color is they started something in New York called the Black Rock Coalition. Uh-huh. And like any rock band that had any connection to African-American culture got in on it. And so you also, like, Ben and I got to see two or three horrible Black Rock Coalition bands that came to Haverford, like in the Black Rock Coalition. And we're like, oh, well, I've heard of Living Color. And it's like, there's a reason you've heard of Living Color. I saw two different Black Coalition bands that like were terrible.
So tell me,
I love that they were community minded in that regard, you know, like
tell me about the racial makeup of the show.
You mean in the audience? It was almost entirely white kids.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. They did not cross over to a black audience. Like, and well, I think that was hard on them. Like, I think they expected that they would have a racially mixed audience. But
Do you think so, really? I wonder if they would have thought that.
Well, remember, they opened for the Stones on the Steel Wheels tour for about 2 weeks, and they were booed. Like, Prince got booed.
What?
Like, Lemmy got booed as the opening act in Steel Wheels, and they were just completely dumbfounded. Like, you know, we play in small clubs and there's 2,500 white kids like with their fists in the air singing along. We try, and when they tried to do it in stadiums to older, larger
white
crowds, it didn't come across. So
yeah, but this does not match with the Stones. That's not,
no, it's a weird choice.
They should have opened for Rush. You know that their favorite band is Rush, and Rush loves them. Like, that's a mutual love affair between Rush and this band. And
I just know that, actually.
That's, oh, you didn't know that? Dude, hilarious. Vernon Reid, when they interview Vernon Reid, he's like, I don't really much care for rock music, you know, basically listen to James Brown and Hendrix, except for Rush. I love Rush.
That's just the greatest. What a cantankerous.
I know, but also, dude, you can hear it. He's not kidding. He really likes Rush.
Yeah, that is freaking hilarious.
And of course, Rush loves them too. I think this is right. I like the second record better.
It's really good. Time's Up. It's aged really well. It falls off a cliff on side two.
Like, is that right? I just
like one's fantastic, but you're not wrong that there's lots of great stuff on the second Living Color record. It's really good.
All right. This is a hard year for me, 1988. There's a lot to choose from. I couldn't go wrong choosing Bobby Brown. I couldn't go wrong choosing the Traveling Wilburys getting together.
By the way, Whitney Houston said the same thing about Bobby Brown to me.
don't tee up the Traveling Wilburys. By the way, I got so much shit. I went on the Age Old podcast.
Oh, what happened? What?
And, to talk about, is it better to burn out than to fade away?
Right.
And they were so pissed by our Graceland take, Ben. Oh, man. They were hell hath no fury. Like Paul Simon fans maligned.
First of all, I am more than happy to go on that podcast and take my lumps. Wait. For sure.
They didn't like your take.
They really did not appreciate our take. They were like, you can't really dislike that. You were doing that for show, right? You can't really dislike that record. Everyone likes that record. I was like, I hate to disappoint you. I love you guys so much and I want you to like me, and I can't like that record, even at the expense of our friendship.
I love the idea that
they had to eat the cultural appropriation, right? At least they admit that. Or collaboration.
I was just trying to get out of the casino with some chips. I didn't push it too hard.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I love the idea that you're doing it for show. Like, you just care about the ratings of your podcast.
I'm after that 45,000 listen for you, Timmy.
That's all I care about. Hey, here's what we're going to do. You guys both chose rather underrepresented bands and elevated them in this podcast. That's what I'm going to do. I, too, will choose an
underrepresented. Are you claiming that NWA is a small, underrepresented band?
At the time. I will go to Ireland to find my band. Don't you shake that head at me, young man.
That's a big fucking surprise.
We're going to go with the Water Boys, and we're going to play some Fisherman Blues. Go.
This was my 1980.
First of all, Let Timmy Eat. Second of all, this is a song you should have chosen. This is the better song in this record. Do it, Timmy.
Fisherman's Blues by the Water Boys.
Tumbling on the seas, far away from dry land and its bitter memories, casting out my sweet life with abandonment and love. Now the ceiling bearing down on me, save the starry sky above with light in my head, you in my
That's one of the greatest. Woo!
Oh man, history.
That one's so good. Yeah,
what a fun bass line. Just hanging out, chilling.
And then the next verse is, "I wish I were a brakeman."
Yeah.
Hurdling evening train.
Yeah.
Like, oh, right. Me too, my brother. If there's anything I would like better than being a fisherman, it's being a brakeman.
Being a brakeman. So fun. But yes, you did pick a song from this album last year, but I do not have to adhere to your.
Fair enough.
We Will Not Be Lovers, 7 minutes and 3 seconds. Not a bad song. Too long. It's overplayed. The looping, like 7 minutes of looping is too much. This is perfect. 4 minutes in, out, like passionate, brokenhearted Irish love song. Oh. That's my jam.
Fair enough.
Give me the 30 seconds of bang on an ear.
Really?
Oh, boy.
You guys don't like that? What?
Oh, boy, Timmy.
You want to get out while you're ahead, man. This
is a fun little song. A ditty.
This is the longest one of the album, 7:33.
9:14. Find vocals
Timmy.
A minute and a half before
Mike Scott of the Water Boys.
Could not have gone Double or Nothing on that one, buddy.
He's so great. Now, does he go and become World Party?
No, someone else becomes
World Party.
Carl Wallinger becomes World Party. Okay. Mike Scott stays the Water Boys.
He does the whole way through.
Yeah. I love that there's a song on this record called World Party just to
fuck
Carl Wallinger for leaving the Water Boys. I think that's hysterical.
And by the way, I'm taking that title.
Yeah.
As I leave.
Yep.
Totally. Well, I told you guys I once lived on a small island off of the west coast of Ireland.
And you have mentioned your affinity for Ireland.
And on that small island, they had a pub. And in that pub, they had pictures of the one night that the Water Boys came to their island and played that pub. It was like a remarkable night in Inishmore history.
I bet that was great.
Yeah.
Have you guys been out to see shows since the world returned? Have you been to a show yet, Timmy?
No. I really got to get it.
It really feels good.
I really
I'm going to see Julian Baker Saturday night. And
nice.
I have tickets for Courtney Barnett coming up, and I'm loving being back out.
You're back in the swings. Well, I got my booster today, so I got three shots in me. I think I'm ready.
And you know, out here, you have to be vaxxed to get in. You have to stay masked through the whole show. It feels pretty safe so far. I haven't had anybody freak me out yet. But am I also right that this is the last podcast we'll record before one of us has a birthday? Or is that wrong?
Seem correct.
Right? Happy birthday to the Knoxville contingent of this podcast, my brother.
When's your birthday?
Friday.
Yeah.
52 years young.
I don't know.
Making 50 years of music and even bigger live.
We got to start auditioning younger guys for this role.
It's got to be like New Edition, right? When one of us gets to like 57, you'll just swap us out.
That's correct. Sorry, you've aged out.
Oh, Timmy, just go ahead and put me out of misery tonight, man.
All right, so I'm going to make a commitment. I got to go see live music. That's what I got to do. In the next week, I'm going to see a live act, and then I'll report
back. Next week, I don't want to put that kind of pressure on you. You might want to wait until something good comes to town.
On Friday. Saturday night, I'm going to go in search of live music, Saturday night in Nashville.
All right.
Or I'll drive to Knoxville. All right. Gentlemen, you hear a knock at Ben's door.
You got a spare room now, right? Empty nest?
I do,
That's right. Sure.
Like the 2 a.m. You said if I was ever in town.
Let's go. All right, gentlemen. You have a great Wednesday night. Ben, you got something to say?
Yeah, man. The great India Kincannon had a very telling comment on Jeff's smithereen selection.
I was hoping you'd forget.
One of the questions that was asked to me, I believe by Timmy, an innocent question. Doesn't India like the smithereens? And I snorted and said no. Then I asked Indy about it. She listened to the podcast. She didn't recognize Wall of Sleep. And she was like, there's a song by this band I know. So she went to Spotify and she listened and she was like, oh yes, I do know some of these songs. And then this is how she summed it up. She hated it. And then I said, well, what do you mean? What do you hate about it? She was like, it's everything I hate about rock music done badly. Which I thought really captured it. It's like loud guitars, dumb lyrics, singing, all in the worst version of it. It's basic.
That is such a telling comment. I can't believe it's not a review of my own record.
you could put that up there.
India Kincannon loves your record, Jeff.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I mean, I've gotten some bad reviews. I recently got a bad review of my single that was similar to that. It was like, if any of this was good, it would be good, but none of it is good, so it's not good. I was like, that is really getting to the heart of it.
You also had very positive reviews about
Indeed.
I had some positive reviews too. Yeah. I find the negative reviews kind of fun. I don't know what it says about
They're more entertaining.
I occasionally get a negative review that makes me laugh. I'm like, yeah, I kind of feel that way about it myself.
Speaking of which, dear listeners, if you want to give us a review, 50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys, go to Amazon, go to Apple Music, go to iTunes, lay down a review, tell us what you think, or we'll just live in the dark.
We'll just
all right, my friends.
Bye, friends.
Hey, if you're having as much fun as we are, leave us a review on iTunes, give us a rating on Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a shout. And then check us out on Twitter or at our Facebook page, 50 Years of Music with 50-year-old White Guys.
Hi, I'm Lessa Godet, host of Her Extraordinary Life by Design podcast, where we celebrate women who are shaping their lives one extraordinary day at a time. I speak with women from all over the world about what they do and how they are passionately pursuing their dreams and creating meaningful impacts on their communities. So come join us and learn about all there is to learn about these extraordinary women.
Today is working for me. Do you believe that for yourself? Hey, I'm Pastor Julie, and I want to empower you through encouragement, inviting you to my podcast, Big Truth Encouragement, where I unpack living a faith-filled life. I created my podcast for the ladies, but gentlemen, you'll gain something too. So I invite you to listen to Big Truth Encouragement on Electricast and any platform where you listen to your podcast.
Electricast.